ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The Country Hour today. My goodness, only a couple of weeks to go until Christmas. Can you believe it? Well, we've still got plenty happening in the ag space, though, today. Coming up on the program, if you've been enjoying this warmer weather, you might have been having some sundowners, perhaps enjoying the fresh tart taste of limoncello. If you've been doing that, you are not alone. It seems a lot of people are enjoying the aperitif.
There's over 100 distilleries in South Australia, and I could say very confidently to you that about 25% of those are making limoncello products or have limoncello products on the shelves.
I'll have that coming up. But first of all, you might have heard about a recent survey that was done that found 3/4 of grain growers who responded to this survey want to pay a lower research and development levy to the Grains Research and Development Corporation. Grain Producers Australia commissioned the survey, given GRDC's cash reserves are at more than $700 million and are expected to be more than $800 million after this harvest. GPA Research and Development spokesperson Andrew Wiedemann says the results should promote action from the Federal Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins.
Yeah, well, look, there's a strong indication there from the growers, which is what we were looking for out of this independent survey that was run independent of all the grower groups. And I think that's the important thing to understand, that this was a very transparent process. There was a number of information sessions that we ran, and there was also plenty of information put out into the local media. But the results have been given to the Federal Minister and the Assistant Minister Chisholm as well. So we're waiting on them. There's a 28-day timeline, because under the Act and the way that this process is been done under the PIRD Act, which is the Primary Industries Research and Development Corporations Act that they actually work to, the Minister's got 28 days to respond to industry.
What sort of response do you expect?
Oh, look, I think because it's the very first time that this has been done as an independent, we would hope that at least the Minister's going to consider some level of change, or they will then look at using the levy payer register, which Grain Producers Australia, and I've been a part of that arrangement to set that up almost a decade ago now, Angus, and so we think that that would probably be a more fair way of getting a judgment right across Australia if that was required. But I think at the moment, when we're looking at another record crop, I think, as we said earlier, we can't really spend it as quick as we're getting it in the door on research that's going to add value. And I want to make that clear. Like, we're not certainly trying to push back on GRDC's investments with this, but it's probably, when we're looking at north of $800 million after this harvest of reserves of cash, plus also the assets that we hold in a number of companies, Intergrain, AGT, and the Accelerator Fund Trust, there's well over $1 billion essentially of grower assets in those formations.
So do you not necessarily expect the Minister to make a change based on this vote, but maybe more of a starting point for a second vote?
Well, that's what I think. I think, generally speaking, I think that that's probably more than the likely the outcome. But I know, look, there's a number of growers out there who actually want change now because they think they can invest their dollar better than GRDC can. And I think that's the message that we've certainly picked up from the sessions that we've run and the sessions and talking to growers more generally. I think even only locally here, I mean, I think most growers are now starting to become aware that the lentil breeding program that they're putting in their paddocks doesn't have any GRDC investment, and yet we just put $30 million 5 years ago into the Vic DPI, and that's been for naught because they've actually closed that up. And so I think there's a fair level of frustration starting to bubble up as well when we're putting money into things, but we actually want to get, as I said earlier, again, applied research in the paddocks, because that's what counts.
And I'm not saying whether this is or isn't the case, and I'm not talking about specific projects, but is there the risk that when you've got $800 million sitting there that nonsense projects get funded?
Yeah, so look, this is a really key point that you mentioned here, Angus, because look, there was a $100 million uplift in the last 2 years by GRDC, actually might be in the last 3 years of actual expenditure on research. So we've gone from around that sort of $200 plus million to over $300 million of investments. And then, of course, on top of that, they've now talked about, after the right size review, of spending an extra $60 million a year just to bring the reserves down. You've got a question, like, if these projects are seriously going to actually add value to the Australian grains industry or not, we will obviously, being one of the two ROs, so the representative organisations that have oversight of GRDC, will be, you know, obviously looking very carefully at the balance sheet and looking at where these expenditures are being spent. But I keep coming back, I suppose, to the key point I want to make, is that it's the research that hits the paddock is the one that makes the benefit to the grower. And I do think there are a number of key areas that we've unleashed, I suppose, of investment. So I talk about Grains Australia as one of those. I think it's a very minimal investment in a group that's actually adding a lot of value to the Australian grains industry through the work that it's doing on behalf of Australian grain growers and levy payers. And I think that the federal government's also realising the capacity that we have now. And we've obviously asked the question of growers around biosecurity. We obviously are the RO that looks after Plant Health Australia, and we're very keen on making sure that that levy investment in that is also commensurate with what we're seeing in the paddock at the moment. And as you're well aware, Angus, like myself, standing out on transmission lines, stopping people coming onto farms, biosecurity has become a very key point, moot point, because farmers are really now concerned about people coming onto their land and transfer of weeds and other issues for them.
Are some of the best cutting-edge grain growers actually ahead of some of the research that's happening? And if that is the case, does there need to be a way of taking that individual work, even though it is from a private business, and sharing it with others and maybe trying to help them catch up?
Yeah, look, I mean, this has actually been something that we've promoted from Grain Producers Australia for the last decade, actually, Angus, is that we've got a number of what I call accelerator farmers who are clearly ahead of the pack in terms of their thinking, the way that they go about implementing new research themselves onto the farm. So they're not using GRDC research, they're actually using their own research and their own money. And then, of course, GRDC is obviously able to leapfrog off that and expand that. And so I use the Ground Cover magazine that GRDC, Grains Research Development Corporation, by the way, are using as that Bible that goes out to farmers. But I think in this electronic age, I'm constantly getting messages from my boys of new things that they're seeing online. And so I think there's a whole range of ways where information is transferring. And there's no doubt that we have got some of the best innovative farmers in Australia. And in a lot of ways, I think back to the Ray Harrington situation, where the Harrington seed destructor, and he developed that himself. GRDC got involved late in the process and were able to actually take it further. And I think that's where the GRDC is at its best in terms of being able to identify through the accelerator program, as they've set up, ideas and innovation out there, and then be able to take that and actually get it in the paddock, because that's where it counts. And that's why we are seeing the benefit of a lot of this, of course, is through that big amount of money that we're banking there. But it's also, unfortunately, at the demise of the livestock sector. We've all seen, since GRDC was developed back in around 1982-83, there's been 100 million sheep lost out of the Australian agricultural industry, and all of that land is now producing grain, essentially, or gone to cattle.
Yeah, it's certainly been a big transition there. That was Grain Producers Australia's R&D spokesperson, Andrew Wiedemann, speaking with Angus Verley there. So this survey was done independently of the state grain organisations like Grain Producers SA, but the president of GPSA joins me now. John Gledigo, good afternoon.
G'day, Cathy. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So what does GPSA make of the survey findings from GPA that grain growers have effectively voted in favour of a change to the compulsory grain levies and how they're distributed?
Sure. Well, I guess, Cathy, there are two bodies who are the representative organisations that have got oversight for the GRDC, being Grain Producers Australia and Grain Growers Limited. And our policy as GPSA is that there be one national voice, which there really isn't at this point of time, and continues to be a constant source of frustration to us. And I guess what we would have preferred is if they would have actually worked together to consult with growers on the GRDC levy. And I think probably that's what the minister would have preferred as well.
Does GPSA, though, think that this finding that there is a mood among grain growers, that there is a change in the way the grain levies are spent and distributed between R&D and biosecurity, things like that, do you get a sense that there is the mood for change among your growers?
That's not really the feeling that we've been getting on the ground, and GPSA is actually the largest paying member of GPA, and we actually didn't feel that we had the opportunity to contribute to the question, which called for a 20% reduction in the RD&E levy. And so, because that's what we weren't really hearing on the ground from our growers, we made the decision to actually go and commission our own a statewide survey in October to capture grain producers' views on the levy rate and on the level of reserves and investment priorities and communications and governance. And our own, because we have a very good base of and we can validate all the growers who contribute, so we had 159 verified responses to that survey, which basically contradicted the what came out of the GPA survey, which had a very small level of respondents. In fact, from what we know, and we haven't actually seen the raw data, but it was less than 400 growers nationally, of which 64%, we were told, were verified NGR owners. Only 7% of those respondents were from South Australia. So that basically gave us 17 growers in South Australia, compared with 179 that came out of our own survey.
So you're questioning just how representative this survey Grain Producers Australia has done?
Well, I guess because that has come out and basically said, I think Andrew Wedderman was talking about over 75%. It was 69% of the national survey that indicated, that supported the drop of 20%. Within our survey, we actually asked different questions. We actually didn't deliberately go to ask a direct levy number question, but 53% of those that we surveyed indicated that they thought the GRDC rate was about right. 35% thought that it could possibly be reduced. And also we had, when we were asked the question around about whether growers felt they were getting value for their levy, received a rating of 5.9 out of 10, which, you know, isn't spectacular, but is certainly in the positive realms anyhow.
So have you spoken with other states about how they view these results, given that Andrew Wiedemann did make it very clear that this was done independently of the state-based grain organisations?
Yeah, I think there's also frustration from the other state organisations as well, that they weren't completely involved in the process, but also, you know, the low level of response from other states. I mean, it was 7% in South Australia, 7% in Victoria, and I think 12% in New South Wales, and close to 50% of the respondents were out of WA. We understand, we haven't actually seen the raw data, and WA has been very strongly and publicly pushing for up to a 50% reduction in the GRDC levy. So I guess, you know, there's some questions there about how that impacts on the overall results of the survey, but our biggest concern is really around the process and around the fact that it's such a low number. The state organisations weren't really involved in the process, and even the fact that the results of this were presented to the Federal Minister, Julie Collins, 12 days before the state representatives even got to see them, which we found a little bit frustrating because it didn't actually give us the opportunity to even discuss them and what the next steps should be going forward. So, and we also know that Grain Growers Limited are doing their own process of consultation around Australia as well on this. And, our view as GPSA, who are certainly looking for there to be one national voice, is that they should actually, or we would love them to all be working together as one. So we do have the one voice and not having, you know, things being torn off in different directions.
Mm. The wool industry reviews their levy every 3 years through Woolpole. Is there a formal mechanism like that within the grains industry to review the levy and how it's spent?
There is a process, but it's not actually time bound. It's actually instigated by industry. There's been some discussion around whether it should be something that's more formal and happens on a more formal nature. I think, within that GPA survey, one of the questions even indicated growers thinking it should even, some suggesting it should be every year, which I think would be very difficult to do. But I think that they are also the questions that we need to be asking ourselves. But in a coordinated approach across between, you know, both ROs and including all SFOs to ensure that we actually have input into what is the best way forward, you know, for our industry.
As was mentioned in the previous interview, this survey result is now with the minister. It sounds like it's just a jumping off point. Are you expecting that it will lead to more discussion, or could there be a result out of this?
I'd be surprised if there was a result out of this. I think Andrew Wiedemann, he kind of alluded to the fact that, you know, it is likely that, you know, the minister might suggest maybe a use of the grower levy register and the two ROs to get together to you know, to come up with another question to put to growers. I would probably think that would be the case, especially because the two ROs haven't actually worked together on this survey, and I think that the minister would expect that. I'd probably also add that the survey that GPSA did, which has had 179 verified growers in it in South Australia alone, we had a formal request from the Federal Minister's Office for that data. So we've forwarded our survey results on to the Federal Minister as well. So that, I guess that all goes into the pot, into the decision that she'll ultimately make.
So is the overarching issue that GPSA has with the findings of the survey, or with the way it's been handled, in that, as you've mentioned, there is the joint RO, representative organisation for grains, which includes GPA and GDL, Grain Growers Limited. Is it the process more than the actual outcome that is the issue here?
Yes, definitely is. It's about the process. I mean, we as GPSA, we certainly aren't saying that the reserves aren't too high, or that the levy shouldn't be reduced. We're not saying that our growers, you know, wouldn't even be thinking that way if with the right consultation and the right questions being asked. But we are concerned about a process where, you know, two organisations that have been asked, you know, by the minister to work together on something haven't. The lack of consultation with the state farming organisations, and even the fact, like I said, that the results were actually presented to the minister before the state farming organisations even had the opportunity to make comment on them themselves on the way through, which we found really disappointing. So yes, it's about process, and you know, if the process is one that we're comfortable with, then we're certainly happy to and very keen to work together with both the ROs to make that happen.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Cathy.
John Gladigo there from Grain Producers SA, just discussing the survey looking at the grains levy. And I'm sure we're going to hear more about that, particularly as was highlighted there, that the process and perhaps the way the grains organisations are working together is being looked at as well. It is 22 minutes past 12.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years in 2025.
I'm Glenn Wilkinson from Snowtown. Congratulations on your 80 years.
I'm James Venning. Yeah, Country Hour's turning 80, so happy birthday, Country Hour. It's been a great, iconic part of the farming landscape.
80 years of the Country Hour.
Yes, this is the Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff. Now, we're going to head to the Country Fire Service before we get weather, just for an update on the incident at the fire at Hornsdale in the state's mid-north on Friday. Two operators of farm firefighting units were reportedly received burns while helping fight the fire. CFS Regional Commander Sydney McCourt joins me. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Can you tell us what happened? These farm firefighting units were assisting at a fire scene?
Yeah, absolutely. They got caught on the wrong side of the fire and were trying to retreat, and actually dropped their Land Cruiser into a gutter and weren't able to get out of the way of the fire front, and managed to keep themselves safe by putting a fog over their unit, but one of them got their face caught by the flames as it went past.
All right. Well, you just alluded to it there, but can you go into any sort of or give us any information about exactly what has happened and how they've been treated?
So the first gentleman burnt his head. That was just treated locally. He never was admitted to hospital. The second gentleman that caught his face, they got him to the RAH to visit the burns unit, which is the best place you can possibly go when you're received a burn like that. They've treated him and then sent him home. So it's not you know, it's not the best outcome, but absolutely everybody's okay. So that's, I'm very happy about that.
No, and it highlights just how dangerous these situations are, even when you've experienced in this field. What happens now, given firefighters often aren't actually under the direct command of the CFS? Well, once they're on the fire ground, I believe they are, but you sort of work in tandem rather than necessarily under the one banner.
I guess that's the importance of understanding why it's important that you register as a farm fire unit, and then you follow, you know, you've undertaken the safety protocols as part of your registration, and you understand how that works so that we can support you if something like this does happen. So the gentlemen's would have been treated exactly the same as any other our volunteers, and we would have looked after them the best we possibly could have.
So what happens now? Will there be any review into what happened?
So we've done a review, so we've had a look at what happened and why it happened. You need to understand fire is very dynamic and it's very influenced by weather. Sometimes things happen that we can't control, and, you know, even seasoned firefighters will get often surprised by what the fire's doing.
Oh, yeah, they're uncontrollable sometimes. It's very difficult to know. Well, I'm sure best service was provided to these people, but I do wish them well. And burns are awful, so hopefully they have a speedy recovery. Thank you so much for bringing us up to date with that.
You're very welcome. Take care.
Cindy McCourt, the CFS Regional Commander, speaking there, that was at the Hornsdale fire on Friday that injury occurred. So we'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now. With this week warming up a little bit, I'm joined by Senior Forecast Jenny Horvath. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
How are things looking at your end?
Yeah, look, it's a little bit stable for the next couple of days. We've got our high pressure system out in the Tasman. It's maintaining a ridge of high pressure. So a lot of clear skies out there, a little bit of high cloud across southern parts, and we'll see that cloud thickening up during the course of the day. There is a bit of a cold front pushing up from the southwest. We'll clip the southeast will clip the tail end of that. So maybe seeing a little bit of light shower activity as we head into the afternoon and evening around the lower southeast. Doesn't look like it's going to push too much further north than that. As we head on into tomorrow, I've got another one of these high pressure systems coming into south of the Bight, so still generally keeping everything pretty mild and settled again on Tuesday, but we do have a bit of a trough that will start to push into from the far northwest. So possibly seeing a little bit of afternoon thunderstorm activity in the far northwest. And I guess in the wake of that change tomorrow, be a bit of a cloudy start across southern parts, maybe a couple of spots out of that, but we're really not expecting any significant rainfall down south on Tuesday with that cloud. Got a bit more of a bit of a cloud band hanging around on the Wednesday there, so moving across the agricultural area. So a little bit of light shower activity not out of the question on the Wednesday there, but mainly around coastal areas. And again, we've got that trough lingering up across the north, so maybe some isolated thunderstorms developing about far western parts and the far northeast on Wednesday. That trough maybe gets a little bit more of a move on Thursday and comes a bit further south. Looks like most of that activity is probably going to be around the northeast pastoral district. And again, those thunderstorms not looking at a lot of rain, but maybe moving a little bit further south and maybe getting as far south as the mid-north and some of the central districts through there on Thursday. And again, that risk in the far northwest continuing. On Friday, though, that trough will start to push a bit more of a cooler airstream into the west there with some southwesterlies following that, and still some unsettled conditions broadly across the state with the chance of thunderstorms. Again, mostly across the eastern border district, but possibly around our central and adjacent districts as well, and then slowly contracting away on the weekend, leaving those temperatures a little bit cooler as those southwesterly winds extend throughout over the weekend there. But as you mentioned, we are expecting to see those temperatures on the rise. So for today, we're generally looking at maximum temperatures near average, maybe a little bit below in the east, but tending to above average in the west. And it's just start to see those temperatures again tomorrow. Generally above average, but still remaining below average in the southeast tomorrow. But by Wednesday, we're generally looking at average temperatures. And by Thursday, we'll see those temperatures grading to well above average, especially about western parts there. So a bit of warmth coming through and a bit of unsettled weather towards the end of the week. So we'll see how that evolves as we get a little bit closer there, Cassie. And looking at those rainfall figures up until the end of Friday, really those falls are going to be pretty patchy and generally less than a couple of millimetres. But if we do get a little bit with those thunderstorms, maybe some very isolated falls, maybe a bit more than 2, possibly up to 10, but not much more than that there, Cassie.
Yeah, it's starting to look a bit more like the summer weather we know in this state at this time of year.
Yeah, that's right. It's like we've come out of that spring. It took a little bit of a while to get us into summer, but it looks like the summer pattern's definitely upon us.
As much as it was surprising, I'm really not complaining. Having a long spring was very beneficial in a lot of ways. So not everyone benefited from it. I know the cherry producers would have liked a bit of warmth, but it's nice to not be
tricky.
Sweltering yet.
That's right. And we have been having a few cool mornings as well, especially across western parts. I think we saw some record minimum temperatures for December there yesterday, and only sort of 4 degrees around Streaky Bay and Cummins. So
we're still
a little bit changeable out there as well, but we are starting to see some warmth come in.
Thank you so much for that, Jenny.
Thank you.
Jenny Horvat from the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, it'll be a sunny morning tomorrow morning in the upper west, and there is the chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the afternoon and early evening. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 17 and 21 degrees, with the daytime temperatures reaching around 40, so rather warm there. And in the lower western, it'll be sunny overnight temperatures there falling to between 14 and 18 degrees, with the daytime temperatures reaching the mid to high 30s. It's 29 minutes to 1.
The Ashes. And the cricket
on. Rushes in and bowls it. Yorker and bowls it.
ABC Sports Summer of Cricket on your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Yes, this is the Country Hour. Coming up, a new study has looked at how plant agriculture and synthetic biology innovations could actually play a role in mitigating climate change by using farming. That's coming up in the next half hour, but first we'll check out what is making news with Matt Coleman. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this afternoon, first-term MP Ashton Hearn has been unanimously elected to lead the SA Liberal Party. The opposition's health spokesperson was the only party member to nominate for the job after Vincent Tarsia's resignation on Friday. Former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce has joined One Nation after leaving the National Party in the final sitting week of Parliament. One Nation leader Pauline Hanson says Mr Joyce will continue representing his electorate of New England until the next election. She says Mr Joyce will then stand as a candidate for One Nation on the New South Wales Senate ticket at the next election. And the Public Service Union says the state's prisons will be in lockdown for the next 24 hours while it undertakes industrial action over better pay and conditions. The union says a stop work meeting was held this morning across South Australia's prisons after a prisoner-on-prisoner assault at Yatala Jail in Adelaide's north over the weekend. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Matt Coleman. There now to grapes. We know what a tough time a lot of grape producers have had in recent years. Well, now wine grape growers can access a calculator tool to work out just how much their grapes cost to grow. This was one of the tools demonstrated at an industry insights meeting held by Riverland Wine. Wine Australia's senior analyst Sandy Hathaway says it's important growers have as much information as possible, with the latest data showing wine production is still outstripping sales.
After a couple of years where we've been eating into stock, this year we had production higher than sales. So of course, that meant we added to national stock again. We don't know like where exactly that stock is. It's just at a national level. But it's not really ideal because it means that bit more of excess inventory that isn't needed and reduces the demand for grapes next vintage because of the existing stock.
That's obviously a great national picture, but is South Australia looking at any really unique challenges right now in our local industry?
That report that I do is at a national level. I mean, you can look at individual regions and varieties, but to be honest, apart from the fact that the decline is more in commercial grapes, so we are seeing a bigger hit in the inland regions, so the Riverland's obviously one of them. In fact, it's our largest region in the country. So there probably is a bit of an extra hit there. But having said that, since the cost of living crisis, so-called, you know, I think people are cutting back a bit on their spending. So, you know, again, there's, you know, maybe they're heading towards more of those cheaper products. But also the Riverland's got a lot of potential to produce some of the more in-demand new products, like new lighter red styles, more whites, you know, sparkling. So, you know, a really affordable product. So they've really, you know, really every region's got to look at innovating and doing what it does best. There are certain regions that seem to be doing extra well at the moment because they're producing Pinot Noir or, you know, like an Adelaide Hills sort of lighter style, Sauvignon Blanc. Some of those regions seem to be thriving a bit more at the moment. But that's a real generalisation. It's probably more just that it's a general challenge to try and recruit new consumers and get them drinking wine instead of RTDs, and everyone's facing the same challenge, really.
The event that we're at here tonight is the Riverland Wine Industry Insights. What are you looking to share with the attendees this evening?
Well, Wine Australia's got these dashboards and tools in particular that are built specifically for the growers to help them have a better understanding of the market conditions. So I'm here, you know, tonight I'm going to be showing them, I think, three in particular that can help them, you know, I won't say forecast prices exactly, but understand what the conditions are and therefore what prices are likely to do next year. Or, vintage 2026, it's like almost next month, isn't it? But, that's my hopes. Show them how those tools work and how they can use them. And we've got another one which is pretty new, which is a calculator on which can show them what their grapes cost them to grow. And they can factor in different water prices, different yields, and then they can look at, you know, what if I got this price for my grapes, would I make any money? So they can use those sorts of tools really easily. We've got a lot of feedback from growers when we built the tools, so it's not just all about us. So hopefully I'll show them and they will find those useful, and they'll help them make decisions for next year.
So you're talking also about industry supports. Do you feel like there needs to be more supports in the industry right now, or how are we looking?
You can probably always do more, and then there's also things that you can't do because, you know, a lot of stuff is down to commercial relationships and you can't just fix them, you know, no matter what you are. Some growers, they would probably like some help to remove their grapevines because it's not cheap to do that. In other countries, there do seem to be a few more removals happening, and in some, like in Europe, they are paying for vines to be removed, but the trouble is they've got a completely different arrangement there. You know, growers have to have a license to grow in the first place. So, you know, here we have a much more free market. At Wine Australia, we fund research and development. So obviously we're trying to fund that, to obviously give people more options, you know, like the mid-strength products, efficiencies, that sort of thing. Big project I'm working on at the moment is to set up a national vineyard register. And, you know, that's like a long-term thing. But if we'd perhaps had one 20 years ago, maybe we could have had a better understanding of what our supply base was and maybe not had some of those overcorrections. This time what we'll probably have is an overcorrection the other way at some point. So hopefully we'll have the vineyard register in place in time to have a better understanding and then better absorb those supply shocks and the cycles. So I'm really keen on that and hoping to, you know, hear from growers that they're keen to get involved with that as well as soon as it's ready to go, which will be another 6 months or so before it's built. But then, you know, we'll hopefully everyone will get on board and we can start using that and getting the benefit from it.
Wine is such a identity piece for South Australia and particularly for the Riverland. And I think a lot of growers are feeling quite existential at the moment about the industry. What do you feel like is the future of wine looking like from where we are now?
Yeah, well, when you put it like that, that's the problem, isn't it? It's all the human stories. Because if you look at it economically, the hard truth is that we don't need as much wine as we have the potential to make and grow. And that's not just true of the Riverland. It's true of Australia. It's true of the US. Like California's in the same position. It's true of all of France and most of Europe. Because there just are these adjustments to consumer demand. So realistically, we probably need a smaller wine industry that is more focused on a sustainable product, because at the moment, no one's making any money. The growers aren't, but nor are the wineries. It's not like the wineries are paying these low prices and making a fortune. No one's making any money. We have the lowest bulk wine price at the moment in the world, Australia, which is not something to be proud of. So we need to get our prices up, and to do that, we need to get our volumes down. So that really is the future. That is a difficult thing, because there's a lot of people that obviously can't then keep growing grapes. We need smaller vineyards or fewer vineyards. But, you know, there's always lots of ways you can reinvent yourself, and these things are slow and take time, and they've happened in other sectors. And, you know, other than that, I don't know where the future's going. Hopefully somewhere exciting, because I think wine still has that very unique position as a storytelling product, and that will persist. And Riverland has so many attributes with the river and the storytelling that goes with it, and all of its fruit and other products, that it, you know, it should be able to keep doing that and just have wine as part of the mix rather than everything.
It's certainly been a tough time, and ongoing for some time. You can often ride out the shorter term issues, but these long term fundamental issues are taking a long time to work out. That was Wine Australia senior analyst Sandy Hathaway speaking with Shannon Pierce there at an event held in the Riverland by Riverland Wine, looking at just some of the ways that that growers can be supported. It's 20 to 1.
This summer, have a safe one by learning your ABCs. A is for action plan. B is for be safe. C is for connect. Find your local ABC radio station. Go to abc.net.au/emergency.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, as something that maybe won't come as a surprise to a lot of people, farms could be a secret weapon when tackling climate change. That's according to a new study which assesses how plant agriculture and synthetic biology innovations can help mitigate climate change using farming. Lead author for the study is Claudia Vickers, who's a professor of synthetic biology and metabolic engineering at Queensland University of Technology. She says the agricultural industry is already at scale, meaning it is one of the most useful ways to tackle emissions now.
I'm a plant molecular biologist by training, and I very quickly realised that most of the things that people are talking about are not scalable to the levels of carbon required to influence climate change or be a significant part of that solution in the time period that we have remaining to do something sensible. However, agriculture, cropland, is 20% of the land surface area of the planet. It's already scaled. It's responsible for about 20% of global greenhouse gas emissions, but it's also responsible for enormous amounts of carbon sequestration. So, you know, a couple hundred gigatons, enormous amounts per annum. Okay, so if we can either increase the sequestration of agriculture as an industry or decrease the carbon loss, even small amounts at that scale can make a huge difference, and we can get to within cooey of meaningful climate interventions.
So an interesting part I found about your research and the way you framed it is sometimes from my conversations, farmers can feel like they're told they're the problem when it comes to, carbon output and climate change. But really you're saying that they're going to have to be one of the key tools to how to solve this, that they're part of the fix, not the problem.
That is absolutely correct. We can't do away with agriculture. Agriculture is what we use to survive. And if we hadn't come up with the sort of the technologies that deliver the food that we eat, well, we wouldn't exist as the current civilization that we do, right? So agriculture has allowed our populations to get very high and supported the effect that we actually have on the planet right now. And it's critical. But it can also form part of the solution, which I think is really exciting. I actually came away from this work feeling really positive, saying, oh, there are things that we can do if we choose the right solutions to go after.
And what are some of those solutions, which are the right ones to be researching and starting to implement?
Yes. So probably number one on my list in terms of impact areas is artificial fertilizers. And if we can decrease those, then we can really have a significant impact. And there's lots of different ways to do that. There's on-farm, there's, you know, decreasing applications, there's point applications. There's a lot of different, I guess, cultural or operational ways we can do that. But we can also look at biotechnological interventions. So nitrogen-fixing bacteria, for example, in the soil and the rhizosphere around the roots. There's some really interesting capabilities or technologies coming out where there are certain types of plants, certain breeds of corn, for example, that secrete this mucilage around the aerial roots, and in that mucilage live nitrogen-fixing bacteria, and the crops are able to extract nitrogen from that and potentially decrease the demand for synthetic fertilizers. So nitrogen fertilizers are the first target. And then there are things, proper biotechnological, serious biotechnological interventions where, so you know how plants fix or take up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and that's actually how crops sequester carbon dioxide. Well, they actually lose 50% of the carbon they have just taken up because the enzyme or the protein machine that does that fixing isn't very specific, and because oxygen and carbon dioxide molecularly look very, very similar, so it's hard to distinguish between them. And for a long time, people have been looking at increasing the efficiency of that process. So that's one possibility, although very, very technically challenging. Something that could be, that is more possible, and in fact is an example that's out in field trials today, is targeting something called respiration. So we breathe oxygen in, we breathe out carbon dioxide. Plants also have a process called respiration where they lose carbon dioxide. And you can introduce what we call a metabolic shunt that removes those biochemical steps that result in the production of carbon dioxide. And it results in a direct increase in biomass in plants. And there are field trials at the moment of engineered plants with this shunt in it that have higher biomass and may indeed even have higher yields. So crop food yields at the end of the day. Now, I think that's super exciting. That sort of thing rolled out across global crops or even, you know, broad scale crops could be really influential. The other thing to flag before I give you any further examples is that the area of the crop is really important. So if you look at, like, say, the global rice crop, it's 150 mega hectares. It's enormous. Even small differences in carbon sequestration or emissions reduction in rice could have a really, really big impact.
So where is the research needed? You've looked into, you gave us a few examples of different things that can be done. Is there one area that you think is more promising or needs more attention?
So something that's interesting about this is that there are things that we can lever very quickly. There's technologies that are available now, and there's a technology that will take longer term, you know, more time to develop the science behind. And certainly things like increasing the efficiency of Rubisco, the enzyme that fixes carbon, or rolling out metabolic shunts, you know, that's going to take time. It takes time to do the engineering. It takes time to do the field trials to demonstrate that it works actually out there in a crop in the field, not just, you know, on the lab and the bench. But there's also very low-tech innovations. And one of them is, for example, if we took the agricultural trash that's burned on farms at the moment, so, you know, the waste that's left over after you've harvested the food part of the crop, but there's quite a bit of that that's burned. But that creates a lot of carbon emissions, it creates a lot of NOx emissions, nitrous oxide emissions, it creates a lot of methane emissions. If you take that biomass, that crop waste, and instead put it through a high temperature pyrolysis process and turn it into biochar, then that carbon actually ends up locked up in a very, very durable molecules. And essentially what it means is that carbon that was in the atmosphere travels through the biosphere, the plants, and into essentially the geosphere, into long-term locked up carbon. And those things are very low tech, can be implemented now, but need development of technology in portable rapid pyrolysis. Then you have interventions in how carbon is sequestered and how carbon is lost in plants, as we've already talked about. And then you have interventions in methane emissions reductions, for example. And those are really important areas. The thing is that right now, a lot of these technologies we can identify, but they come from basic funding and from, you know, basic science and research within the university sector, within CSIRO, and ensuring that those organisations are delivering the technology and the research advances needed, even when it's a long time to delivery of the technology in the lab, is really critically important in Australia, I think.
Some interesting thoughts there by lead author Professor Claudia Vickers from Queensland University of Technology, or QUT, who's speaking with Elsie Adamo. It is coming up to 10 minutes to 1.
Medicine sold like a makeover.
I left that place thinking I found myself a solution.
But it's your body that pays the price.
Something's wrong here. Oh, I never experienced that in my entire life.
Before and After, a new series on how medical hype spreads online. Search for Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, there might be a few of you out there who've tried to make or at least tasted a backyard batch of limoncello. It can bring mixed results, but this Italian lemon liqueur has traditionally been homemade and gifted using surplus lemons. But limoncello is having a bit of a moment among Australian distilleries. Usually it's made using a grain or a cane spirit, but in the wine state of South Australia, it's being made using grape spirit and Riverland lemons. So we've got both the core ingredients to this. Eliza Berlage took a look at what's behind this trend.
Limoncello, the lemon liqueur, seems to be everywhere at the moment. It's an alcoholic drink that hails from southern Italy, and it's often consumed as an aperitif or digestive, but lately it's appearing in spritzers in cocktail bars in capital cities. Distillers South Australia Executive Officer Chloe Reschke-Maguire says limoncello is experiencing a global surge in popularity.
There's over 100 distilleries in South Australia, and I could say very confidently to you that about 25% of those are making limoncello products or have limoncello products on the shelves, either in retail liquor stores or in bars, or selling them in their own tasting rooms in South Australia as well. It's a really, really popular product at the moment, and we certainly are seeing a rise in those kinds of lower alcohol products that can be made into cocktails or can also be sipped deliciously just fresh out of the freezer.
Ms. Reschke-Maguire, who has Italian heritage, says it's often produced by families and presented as a housewarming gift.
And traditionally, families would get together, they would have a surplus of lemons, or they would go and handpick lemons together, and they would then make the limoncello themselves together and finish the day with a feast together as well. So that the actual production of the product is steeped in culture and tradition too.
What a gorgeous gathering. And because I feel like you see or hear a lot more in pop culture about the making the passata tomato day is in quite a few films and books, but I haven't heard as much about the limoncello day.
Yes, the limoncello day often comes around at the same time that obviously lemons come into season. So you'd be talking about it right now as well, when you have that surplus of lemons growing, that beautiful hot climate. South Australia is also very reflective of southern Italy in terms of its climate. And southern Italy is where limoncello originated from and is still made primarily today. South Australia has that really temperate climate in which lemons grow really well. We have a slightly acidic soil, which is perfect for lemons. And I think that's why here as well, lemons grow so well. And you know, again, still traditionally brings families together. My family, part of my family is Italian, and we still get together and actually do make our own limoncello at home as well.
So how is limoncello made? Finn Healy is the managing director of Adelaide-based Ambra Spirits, who use a 100-year-old family recipe.
Ambra was founded in 1998, nearly 27 years ago, by a gentleman called Libero De Luca. So Libero was quite a famous local restaurateur. He had a few pasta joints and pizza places and stuff through the 80s. When he retired, 65 or so, went back to the Amalfi Coast to spend some time with family, started making the family limoncello over there and fell in love with the process and saw the opportunity to bring it back to Australia. And to this day, that recipe hasn't changed. What we do is we go to the Riverland, pick fresh lemons straight off the tree. So completely untreated, unwaxed, as raw as they come. Then we bring them back to our warehouse here in Severn. We peel them. So you want to make sure you peel the very, very edge of the rind. And if you go too deep, it gets quite bitter. You then take all the peel, you infuse it on spirit. So we use a grape-based spirit from Tarrick, which is essentially all of the spent grapes from local South Australian wineries, which is pretty cool, high-quality grapes. We infuse it for a secret amount of time. Then we essentially turn it into a cello by balancing out the ABV, so the alcohol percentage, to 25% with pure water and distiller's sugar, making it a liqueur or a limoncello.
In the Riverland, 23rd Street distiller, head stiller Paul Burnett, has also created a limoncello from grape spirit and local lemons after experimenting with cane and grain spirit.
I'm totally in the same company of those people that have made a bad limoncello. It was the advice of our executive chef here that really tweaked it from being probably a B-grade limoncello to being an A-grade. And that was the concentration of the grape spirit and then the time interacting with that to making sure we peel only the most gentle zest of the lemon, or the flavour dough, as it's called. So the next round's about to happen because we've had great success with this. We only did a very small production, about 1,000 bottles. So yeah, we've got the lemons picked from Engie Citrus, and we'll peel today, tomorrow, and we'll do some steeping for approximately 2 days, and then the majority of that lemon will be taken off. There'll be a little bit of interaction with those oils and the citrus oils that come out of the skin, and then we'll do that blending when required with the sugar and hit that final alcohol of 23.
Eureka lemons, like, how did you decide that was the lemon for this limoncello?
Through some trials, and then in talking to the farmer, talking to Michael Ingerson, his suggestion was to use those Eureka lemons. And yeah, a couple of different batches. So we initially looked at cane spirit, grape spirit and grain spirit, and sort of toyed around incorrectly with levels of alcohol. So sometimes 40 and 50% you were steeping at, and then pinpointed that the grape spirit was the best for the blend. And then yeah, John's advice, the executive chef here, to use a higher alcohol. So we're steeping it at a higher alcohol, so you get a more rapid extraction of those oils. And then the time on that zest of the lemon. And so we'll just mimic again that process, and hopefully we'll do tiny little tweaks to get it as good, if not a little bit better, that second batch.
What was it particularly with the Eureka lemons that seemed like the right fit compared to, you know, how many other varieties that you tried?
I guess at the forefront of what we want to do here is always source locally. So we do that with many of the botanicals in our gins, we do that. And with our brandies, we want to source local grapes. So a couple of trials of a couple of different lemon trees, and then the proximity of Bukpenong to us. So it was quick to get them picked, get them here, get them peeled as quickly as possible.
Hand peeling?
Yes. So I've got a bit of RSI after doing, you know, 200 kilograms of lemons, but it was fully worth it. But yeah, just as we were tasting it, it was around that third day of steeping that the flavours peaked. So it was time to get it off skins, so off the majority of the solids. And then we kept it high alcohol for a few days to get a bit more extraction of those oils. But yeah, a real premium focus was very good spirit base, grape spirit, selecting a really good cocktail liquid sugar. And then I guess the Eureka lemons, it was the final trials using that.
23rd Street Distillery, head stiller, Paul Burnett, ending that story from Eliza Burlage. Now, you can read more about that story online at abc.net.au/rural. You can find out a lot of great other information on what's happening in agriculture right around the state. I did get a bit excited in that story when they said Eureka lemons were the ones to use, because I have a Eureka lemon tree in my garden, but it's never been a great producer. I don't know whether it's possums or birds, or perhaps I'm just not a particularly good grower of lemon trees, but yeah, mine doesn't produce enough to really get on that limoncello trend. But if you do, sounds like a lot of people are enjoying the taste of limoncello at the moment. So maybe it's worth a go as we come into the season for it. That's about all we have time for in the program today. But given today is the day that it closes, I thought I'd let you know that you can vote for the People's Choice Award in the Global Great Wine Capital's Best of Wine Tourism Awards. We'd love to see a local winner, given it is a global award. These awards celebrate innovation and excellence in wine tourism across the world's great wine regions. There are six South Australian businesses in the running to be crowned the world's favourite. They include Mount Lofty House and Estate and Vintaloper, which are both in the Adelaide Hills, Wonderground Barossa, Maxwell Wines and SA Bikes, both in McLaren Vale, and Bottle Shock in Gummaraka. So voting for the People's Choice Award closes today. So if you would like to get involved in that, you can go to the Great Wine Capital's website and search for the People's Choice Awards. It would be great to have some Australian or South Australian winners in there for that award. I mentioned the website there if you want to catch up. If you do want to catch up on Country Hours as well, we podcast the show every day. Just search for SA Country Hour wherever you find your podcasts and take a listen. If you want to catch up on the 80th celebrations last week, or just wanted to catch up on a story, it's there waiting for you. It's coming up to 1 o'clock though now, and it's almost time for news.
The Country Hour,
part of your community
and your life.
Oh, it's a bit of mix.
For 80 years.
Everything is buzzing and eating.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
That's all part of the magic.
On ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.